Hello everyone, welcome to the Walk podcast. My name is Jenny Chan and I'm the China editor here at Walk. Today we're going to evaluate the past and future movements of Chinese brands going global. So we're all familiar with names in the first wave of international expansion like Huawei, Lenovo, Haier, you know, mostly in the telecoms and consumer electronics. And from the 2010s, smartphones and e-commerce brands like Xiaomi, Oppo, Vivo, and even AliExpress became essential, and they are here to stay. The new kids on the block are digital players like Shein, Temu, TikTok, Didi, and a lot more D2C startups. And you can probably use two or three words to describe them: controversial, aggressive, successful, question mark. Together, all these companies are the defining features of China's outbound movement. With me today in Shanghai is an expert in this space. Please welcome Chris Baker, founder of Totem Media.
Hi, Jenny.
Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good to see you again. We're originally a China-based agency that focused for the first 7 years of our life. We're about 10 years now. The first 7 years of our life as a business, we're very focused on helping global brands come into China. And over the last 3 to 4 years, we've really seen kind of that trend reverse a little bit. While we still help global brands come into China, we've been really active in following the outbound trend for brands going global. And with that, you know, we've worked on a range of briefs from, you know, really large, well-known Chinese enterprises like Tencent Media or Tencent Music, Amazfit, on helping kind of do strategy and planning for global PR and communications, through to influencer and PR work with people like Floresis, and then a lot of work in helping new Chinese brands get their brand right for global expansion. So that involves doing kind of soup to nuts branding work, figuring out like what's the brand identity, how do we communicate the brand effectively globally, and then really putting together that playbook that they're going to use to start expanding. So on that side of things, we've worked with brands like GRST, which is a lithium ion battery company that has a large presence already across China and they're expanding globally. We've also worked with a large holding group called Esquel Group, who has a number of fashion brands. One brand in particular called Determinant that I think we've done some really nice work with.
Yeah, so it looks like a good roster of different brands and different stages of development, both in the B2B and B2C space.
Yeah.
And I hear a common refrain is that they are already quite established in the domestic market before they start to venture out, right?
Yeah.
And whether it's established brands or maybe some of the platforms that we've been hearing about in the news, these guys would have had many years inside China to fine-tune their techniques, whether it's algorithms or marketing strategies, to apply globally. But one thing I've heard is not to just simply replicate your success, domestic success in the foreign markets. Have you had any sort of pushback or difficulties in sort of helping them to understand this golden rule?
Yeah. So we've been monitoring this trend for a number of years now. And it's roughly 50-50 between brands that have previous China experience before going global versus, you know, the other 50% or thereabouts are brands that are designed with the idea of going global from day one. So I would say that regardless of if they have previous China experience or they're designed from day one to be a global brand, there is a little bit of a learning curve that has to take place, right? Obviously, for the ones that are designed to go global from day one, we're doing a lot of work just helping kind of them understand markets better, customer insights, and then some of the rules around marketing and branding to really hit the mark. Whereas for brands that are developed in China first that then have to adapt, yeah, we're trying to break some habits, right? And there's a lot of work that goes into helping them relearn some of the things that they are going to have to do to kind of be successful globally. Having said that, I think what's interesting, given our background, is that, you know, we kind of stand with a foot in both China and global, and a lot of our team have the background of marketing in China. So we're really putting in place a lot of plans that I think balance the difference in terms of, okay, this is a plan that the China brand team is really going to understand, but is going to be really applicable globally. And I think as a student of both marketing ecosystems between China and global, we're starting to see a lot more kind of those two systems coming together, right? Where right now in the West, I think some of the hottest trends are around what's happening on TikTok, for instance, and social commerce and the use of live streaming and influencers to really create hype and build that kind of brand momentum. And so for the Chinese brands jumping into that space, they understand that intrinsically, like that's their bread and butter in China already. So we don't have to do a lot of coaching there, right? The majority of the coaching goes into really like, how do you hit the right mark in terms of brand story, where a lot of the Chinese brands tend to be kind of very biased towards performance marketing.
Yeah, we definitely see a strong bias because that's what the Chinese brands are used to in the domestic market, sort of going performance oriented because you can see results immediately. Yeah. And who doesn't like to see results because it gives them impetus to move on.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I mean, you know, like what we see with a lot of the brands that are Chinese brands, global first China brands, is that, you know, when they're coming to us, they're probably already at a, they've already established a little bit of a foothold globally through their work on platform e-commerce, like on Amazon or increasingly like on Shein or Temu or something. You know, they've ridden performance marketing to real success already globally as well. So they're like really dialed in this kind of performance marketing playbook. And there's a real gap that we need to help address from that to how do you become more direct to consumer? How do you really build kind of the brand level of your overall marketing?
When I talk to Chinese outbound brands, they justify this strategy by saying, if you don't even have a little bit of sales, then you can't really be qualified to do brand building. Mm. So that's how they see it. They say they feel that they have to earn their spot to start building a brand by having at least some decent sales in the back.
Yeah.
And from just an external point of view, the bias between relying on e-commerce platforms and sales channels, distributors, dealers, as early stage growth, be it the rising stars, you know, starting out on Amazon or the large national champions with all the SOE backing, there is a similarity there that they usually underplay the role of direct marketing and branding, maybe until it's too late.
Yeah.
So how do you know, or how do you advise them? When does a brand know, okay, this is the point where we have to level up and then start taking the next step to build brand equity?
Yeah. I would probably address that by saying branding is, as a word, or brand as a word, is kind of a fuzzy idea actually, right? So I would define branding as maybe having several constituent parts. I think first and foremost, you know, brand is about building trust and goodwill and having a story that people can easily understand and connect with. And so I generally would hope that a brand from day one or close to day one has just the basics in place for success, right? I would separate that from the notion of branding as a big campaign, brave moves on activations as a separate thing, because I do think for the most part, new brands have to focus on getting revenue lines going, and performance is the quickest way for them to do that. But if you jump into that performance space without having your house in order and things clear and a good story and things ready to kind of build trust, then it's going to be really hard to make that jump. If I was to outline, you know, like a three-step process, I would say that, you know, step one is like get the house in order, make sure that the brand fundamentals are there. Step two is yeah, really drive growth and through performance. And then step three would be, let's think about what are some of the big, brave moves that we can make that kind of help the brand vault up to the next level. You know, we're advising them towards a strategy that they have to internally implement. Well, it's got to be something that they're capable of, right? So that often means that, you know, we're to start advising them towards using platforms that they'd be really comfortable and capable of implementing. So rather than having to, you know, big brand efforts offline or through non-digital channels, we'd probably say, let's start with TikTok, right? Or YouTube, one of those channels that they necessarily already understand because they've been working and living in this digital first environment in China, right? So we kind of probably focus on, because most of them will start with Amazon first. You know, the stepping stone then becomes like, let's look at some of the other complementary digital channels to augment branding. The problem with Amazon is not a branding platform at all, right? Where in China, some of the e-commerce platforms actually have a bit of a brand rub and they're quite good at generating social momentum. Amazon just doesn't have that. And so, yeah, we really want to see those brands augment Amazon with at least a couple of other complementary digital social commerce channels first.
Do you think TikTok might be the new sort of crowning glory? Because if it follows the China playbook, it will probably have both content, commerce, engagement, you know, even fulfillment. That's what they're promising the Chinese brands.
Yeah.
Would that be the new playground, you know, the end-to-end playground for Chinese brands taking over the other Western walled gardens?
For sure. So yeah, we see it both with Chinese brands that are going global as well as global brands who are looking at TikTok and trying to figure out how to build strategies for that. I mean, it's no surprise. I mean, TikTok is, you know, the hottest, fastest growing app in most markets globally. And the set of features and functions that TikTok has planned for rollout are formidable, and they follow very much the playbook that they already have in China, right? So it's, yeah, social first, of course, right? Where they've already developed huge amount of equity and commitment from audiences. And then it's around how to use influencers and live streaming to connect that already hyper engaged audience with an e-commerce output. And then the next things in that playbook are direct shops and fulfillment and really becoming the sharp end of this social commerce spear globally, right? You know, noted in our report also was the fact that for the first time ever, I would imagine Facebook and Amazon are coming together doing cooperation between Facebook shops and Amazon. And I think that signals a little bit of nervousness on their part around the threat of TikTok. So, yeah, I think TikTok is both for Chinese brands as well as global brands at the moment, got to be, you know, very high on your priority list.
Yeah, we can't run away from the power of the online platforms for sure.
Yeah.
I also remember in your report, there was a observation that the Chinese brands, yes, they know how to play digitally, but they're also not traditional enough, quote unquote, meaning their media mix is not robust enough. They maybe don't consider the traditional media in some countries. It could be India, Sweden, you know, that has still a large population spending quite a large amount of time on traditional media. So how would you advise the clients to sort of, you know, balance their media mix a little bit more?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the roles of a media planner or strategist is to find underpriced attention. You know, that's one of the things we're always trying to look for on behalf of the brands that we work with. And, you know, I think that traditional media in a lot of markets represents a unique opportunity to break through. But for Chinese brands, I think that they're a little bit, it's a bit of a blind spot for them because, you know, China is an environment, you know, some 80, 90% of all advertising budgets in China go towards digital. Things like TV, print, radio are almost forgettable here and not relevant. So when Chinese brands are looking overseas, especially early in their growth, they're really favoring digital media. You know, I think to legitimize their brands at a certain stage in their growth, you know, they really have to start looking at some traditional media, because those traditional media still play really important role in other markets. I won't say mature markets, because equally in Europe, as well as, you know, many places in Southeast Asia, for instance, you know, print, TV, and other traditional media are really important.
How about the bigger established, you know, champions, the guys that have been out on the global stage for a long time now, you know, Huawei, Xiaomi, and all that. Are they? Do you see them actually valuing the importance of this underpriced attention and using attention metrics on media, media platforms, and, you know, really being more mature in the strategies?
Yeah, no, for sure. We did the ranking and report 2.5 years ago, and then the most recent one was just a couple months ago. And, you know, there's real notable shift in terms of the maturity of the playbooks, especially among the larger brands, right? I think one of the brands that comes to mind from our research was Hisense in the US. Yeah, they've done some really impactful work using TV as well as online TV, brand sponsorships with the NBA, so which includes a lot of offline and out of home, to, you know, really, I think, kind of become much more of a household name, right? And I don't think you do that at a certain level unless you start getting into that space of using a complement of 5-6 media in concert, right? Because that's the point at which you go from being this very niche player to something that everyone has seen fairly often in the day-to-day life.
Do you think guys like Hisense succeeded because they've got the backing of the state, or because of the blessing of their strategic insight in terms of marketing? I mean, it might be an unfair question to ask, but I just want to narrow down some of the factors of success and then learn marketing lessons from what they have done.
Yeah, I think it's largely down to the maturity of the teams inside the brand and how long they've been working on the problem, so to speak, or the challenge of breaking through in global markets. I think that's number one. And I don't think in that respect that it necessarily makes a difference between whether or not they're kind of state supported or not. So that's one. And then in the case of people like Hisense, I mean, they've got really mature senior marketers on the ground in the US, right? And, you know, so there's a person running their efforts there who's really well informed, has a background with other similar electronics companies in the US, and knows how to take them from where they're at now kind of to that next tier. So I think those are the two things. It's really about maturity and readiness of the brand to make that jump. I think, though, that this brings us back around to one of the big challenges for Chinese brands, and that is that they, perhaps more than any other country's brands, need to prove legitimacy, right? You know, and there's a little bit of this kind of negative rub on Chinese brands. And so there's a little bit of a race for a lot of them, I think, between casting off some of that, you know, I don't know, call them negative feelings about China, right? Or trying to get to become a household name quicker than that rub of being a Chinese brand catches up with them, right?
Yeah, they are a little bit in a sticky point, because we all know that they are facing headwinds, some of it, you know, influenced by the political sphere.
Yeah.
And this is despite them working really, really hard and achieving massive improvements in quality. And it's fair to say they have shaken off the copycat claims, at least in the most of the consumer sectors, but the confidence level with consumers are, as you said, lacking. And it doesn't help that there are silly stories like your coffee maker from China spying on you, and surveillance through their, maybe the vacuum cleaners that's produced by Chinese producers. So You sit part of your time in the Americas, near the Americas in Canada. The perceived hostility must be a bit more pronounced there. So what stories have you heard, and what kind of soft skills do you think Chinese brands need to develop to sort of charm the enemy over?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the average consumer probably doesn't think or care that much. I think a lot of the narrative is driven by media. So I think that's the first thing to keep in mind. But again, going back to a previous point I touched on, I think there's a goal, especially for larger Chinese brands that are on the global stage. Part of the goal has to get, you know, move quickly enough to kind of outpace that kind of negative PR that comes with being associated with China. At this point, people like TikTok and Shein and probably Temu are so big and so entrenched and loved in many cases by their audiences that it's really hard for anyone to take them down, right? Like, it would be really hard to take TikTok away from, you know, Gen Z in the US at this point, right? So I think, you know, it all comes back to, you know, I'm a brand guy at heart, right? And I think that brand can kind of mask small problems. A strong brand can help push you past some of the small things that are irking your business, right? And I think that, you know, building that brand, building that trust, right, is important, because then you've got a set of consumers that, regardless of bad press, will have your back as a brand. So I think that's really key. Mm. Not all Chinese brands are building that trust, right? I previously did consulting with a number of the early players in kind of factory direct to the US and global. And I can tell you from the experience at looking at their numbers, they had like negative brand equity, right? Like they had, you know, 10, 20 times the number of bad comments as they did good comments, because they were really failing their end consumer with quality. But the more recent players are making incredible strides. You know, Shein and Temu are light years better than some of the earlier players like DHgate, for instance, right?
Are there any concrete steps to, say, build trust? We sort of fundamentally understand that it's also a human-to-human thing. The hygiene factors that a brand needs to fulfill, you know, promising the customer good quality, customer service, repairs and returns, you know, sticking to what you've promised to the customer. Are they already doing that? Should they be doing more? How should they show their sincerity to a foreign consumer that is on par with the category leader of, say, mobile phones or consumer electronics?
Yeah. Look, I think you've touched on probably what will end up being one of the biggest gaps for a lot of Chinese brands going global, because strictly speaking, on a objective measure of quality of whatever the product is at this point, if they're not at parity with global brands, they're pretty close in a lot of categories, right? Mobile phone makers from China, well, they've got to be, I don't know, if they're not 100% in terms of the hardware comparable to Apple, they're 95%, right? Where the shortfall is going to come is in that service infrastructure and the ability to be present in a material way in the markets that they operate, right? So as an example, in the mobile phone category, yeah, you've got really high quality phones being dumped into markets around the world with zero customer service or even marketing to support it, right? And so the promise that brands in these kind of higher consideration, higher involvement categories like mobile phones and EVs or cars make is that there's a service to back them up, right? And that becomes one of the things that rests out here as an as yet unsolved problem for a lot of Chinese brands.
Yeah, and they're using pricing as one of the main advantages to grab market share and to perhaps foster loyalty, because there is a view that if you have a low price enough, it's attractive, it's affordable in this sort of financial climate, and you keep going back to buy it, right? So that assumption in itself, yes, it is valid in some circumstances. And I want to draw your attention to the report, because you mentioned the top 100 list and all these brands venturing outbound. You've measured their impact mostly around brand potential, social media engagement, and of course sales. And but I saw that you wrote that it was a case of quantity over quality. So we've talked a bit about the good players, the top players. Could we look past them and analyze why the cohort that's not doing so well? Why are they weak? I don't want to keep drawing on the negatives, but you know, just to draw out factors that we should definitely avoid. It's like a no-no red flag.
Mm, yeah. I mean, just stepping back a little bit to kind of address the larger value equation for Chinese brands, right? So I think one of the observations we made in this report, and goes back to work I've done throughout a long period of time in China with outbound, is that, you know, during periods of like we have economic downturns globally, like 2006, we saw a massive surge in factory direct products to overseas, right? And at the time, there was this idea of, you know, the value equation was right. You know, when consumers' budgets were shrinking, in steps, you know, this product from China that is, I don't know, 70% of the quality they were buying before, but it's at 30% the cost. That's a great value equation in a down market. But from a sustainable brand growth point of view, that's not enough, right? In a lot of cases, because you just don't get repeat purchase, right? If the value equation swings too far in the wrong way. So I think that there's two things going on here in the coming period of time. I think, you know, it seems like a large parts of the world are going through a bit of an economic downturn. So that's going to give a lot of opportunity for Chinese brands with the right price to value equation. But for the brands that really want to make a long-term impact, they need to start to tell a story and with customers that goes beyond this kind of, you know, very transactional one-off experience that they might have through purchasing on Amazon or Shein or Temu, right? And they need to, I always say, give consumers a reason to tell their friends that they bought this thing, right? And so that goes back to quality first in terms of the product. Second is that somebody doesn't feel sheepish about the fact that they bought this no name or kind of awkwardly branded thing. Like, I want to be able to show to my friend, like, hey, this is an amazing thing. I got it for half the price of what you would pay for whatever global brand, and it works really well. And oh, by the way, the brand is actually kind of cool too, right? Like, that is a home run for a Chinese brand that's trying to make an impact, right? The problem is that this over focus on performance and working through channels, you know, leaves most of the Chinese brands with global ambitions well short of that, right? In the course of our research that we did a small case study on was a battery company called Bluetti, who has, in addition to kind of their regular marketing work on YouTube with video, is they did a video series highlighting people who use their remote battery units to power an off-grid lifestyle. So they interviewed, you know, people who were living in rural US and talking about their stories and the background. And I thought that, you know, that was a signal to me of a company that, and I know the background of that company from work in the category, where they've already had real breakthroughs with doing things like Kickstarter campaigns that have been among the top on Indiegogo and Kickstarter. They've done really strong work in building scale through digital ads. And this represents kind of that next step towards maturity, right? Which is really strong use of videos and creating an emotional connection.
Last question, because 2024 is a big sporting year. And in your report, you mentioned some of the Chinese sponsors of this global sporting event sometimes become vanity projects because they don't have the branding fundamentals to sort of support that huge sponsorship to have that momentum go on. So maybe one line of advice for brands, you know, hoping to use sports as a marketing tool in 2024, how to not let it become just a vanity project.
Yeah. So as you say, I mean, you know, a company that has jumped in and become a primary sponsor of a World Cup or an Olympics and hasn't kind of filled out all the stuff that sits below that in terms of foundational marketing efforts, it sort of just feels like this Hail Mary where we're throwing this massive expense at this big thing, but we haven't done all the work to connect that really big idea with all the things that connect on all the other levels. So instead of just sponsoring World Cup, well, they should probably be also involved at grassroots level of soccer, right? And getting involved in other activities and content around the world of soccer to really connect and connect it to that big idea.
I think I look forward to the day where I can see Chinese brands both on TV, on the screen, on the mobile phone, and in the community, in schools, on bags, on lunchboxes. I think that's a true barometer of a Chinese brand really integrating itself into an overseas consumer's mind. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thanks, Jenny. Great to talk to you.
And to Walk listeners, thank you for listening. If you enjoy what you heard, please subscribe to the Walk podcast on your favorite platform to make sure you never miss an episode. Be sure to tune in.